Hello, everyone, and welcome to True Crime Talker San Diego, episode number 19. As always, I'm your host, Jamie. Thank you guys so much for being patient with me and wishing me safe travels. That really did mean a lot to me. If you didn't already know, I did have to skip last week's episode due to traveling across country for a family function. I hope you guys enjoyed seeing some of the clips and behind-the-scenes moments as I produced episode 18 from a motel and on the road. That was quite the experience. I always post behind-the-scenes content on the show's Instagram, and the link to that is in the show notes, so if you're not already following us and would like to see some bonus content, go check it out. It was really nice to see family, but I am also very happy to be back home in lovely San Diego and get back into the swing of things. Speaking of which, I've got a really interesting case for you all. It's an old case from the 1930s that went unsolved for over a decade. But before I give too much juicy details away, let's switch gears and jump into today's news story topic. This Monday morning, the 24th, around 10:45 a.m., a 911 call came in to report some sort of family violence nearby. 34-year-old Abdil Sarabia had become upset with his family members and attacked his 22-year-old sister in the yard. Carmen Hernandez is Abdil's aunt and lives next door. She ran out to intervene in the siblings' fight. She was struck by her nephew and fled back to her home for safety. Her son, 18-year-old Alberto Suarez, was shocked to see his older cousin break down and burst through the front door of their family's Escondido home, wielding a knife. Alberto fought to keep the door closed, but he said his cousin muscled in and ended up stabbing his arm. He then continued to stab Alberto's younger sister and then attacked his mother, Carmen. The assailant stabbed Carmen several times, including her arms, her neck, her face, and even her eye. Alberto pushed his cousin off his mother and said to stab him instead. He offered himself up as a distraction and took off running, luring his cousin about a quarter mile down the road, away from his family. Police arrived on scene and arrest Abdil Sarabia on suspicion of attempted murder, assault with a deadly weapon, mayhem, and other charges. Alberto's sister, Rivera Hernandez, called her brother a really big hero. He was willing to die for her and saved their mother's life. The courage that must have taken is just incredible, and he truly does deserve the title of hero. I can't even imagine what it must have been like to be in his shoes, so my heart goes out to him and his family, and I hope they all recover safely. Carmen Hernandez was released from the hospital on Thursday. It's too soon to know if she'll regain sight in her eye, but the doctors are optimistic. The family has created a GoFundMe entitled Hernandez Family Recovery Bills. The money will help pay for their recovery and a possible need to move. So, if you have the means to help out this inspiring family, the link to their GoFundMe will, of course, be in the show notes below. On the evening of August 31st, 1936, a woman was sitting on the beach watching the ocean waves ebb and flow under the full moon. Little did she know, she had fallen prey to a murderous predator.
Ruth Muir, 48, daughter of a San Antonio banker, was found beaten to death today. Police have rounded up 20 suspects and are questioning them to find out who killed Miss Muir.
Who killed her indeed? This is the case of Ruth Saquette Muir. Ruth lived in San Diego back in 1936. She worked as a secretary at the YWCA in Riverside. For those of you who didn't know, because neither did I, YWCA stands for Young Women's Christian Association. I visited their website because I didn't know what they did or if they were even still around. But thankfully, yes, they are still around, and here is how they describe themselves on their website. Founded in 1908, YWCA of San Diego County empowers individuals and families to break the cycle of domestic violence and homelessness and achieve self-sufficiency. Together, we are eliminating racism, empowering women, and promoting freedom, justice, and dignity for all. Sounds like a really great mission, and it honestly gives me so much more respect and insight into who Ruth really was. Now, sadly, there really isn't much I could find about Ruth as a person and her background, which is just so sad to me because in old cases like these, I really want to know who the victim actually was. But oftentimes, that information is just not reported. Only the details of the crime are reported, and the focus being majorly on who the killer is. So, when looking into Ruth Muir, I see that she comes from Texas. Her father was a banker in San Antonio, and she was the only daughter out of three children. I wish I could find out what brought Ruth to leave her family in Texas and come out to San Diego. I originally suspected it was due to a husband's work or some sort of job opportunity, but upon further investigation, that is not the case. Ruth was never married, and she was even referred to as a spinster. So, she's 48 years old and seemingly living alone in San Diego. This is pretty unusual for a woman to be living alone back in the 30s. When I found out she was a secretary at the YWCA, my perspective of her changed and she became even more interesting to me. Now, this is just me speculating and projecting, but to me, Ruth is not your typical 1930 woman. She had no desire to fit into the cookie-cutter idea of what a woman's role ought to be. She never married and became someone's housewife, nor did she have any children. Instead, Ruth lived an independent life. She had her own job and cared about women's rights and helping others. Learning more about Ruth's background made this case all the more tragic to me, but I'll come back to that thought later on. On the evening of August 31st, 1936, Ruth was watching the ocean waves in La Jolla when a killer crept up upon her and dragged her to the nearby ravine. Ruth was raped and seemingly beaten to death due to a concrete block found at the crime scene, which was stained with blood. Her body was found the next day, and the entire city was sent into a panic. Long before the term serial killer was coined, the San Diego area was experiencing a series of unsolved, seemingly random, and violent acts of murder against women. This led people to believe that a serial killer was on the loose. Police suspected that these murders were at the hands of one killer, which they called the Coast Fiend Killer. The fiend's killing spree began in 1931, and every time a victim was discovered, the city was sent into a panic state, and Ruth's murder in 1936 was no exception. The police got busy investigating her murder in an attempt to catch the killer. Authorities questioned over 20 men about Ruth's case, looking at anyone with a record of violence. From looking at newspaper articles written back then, the police seemed to be detaining suspect after suspect after suspect, but none ever stuck and were eventually released. I honestly imagine like a cartoon police station with a revolving door that was just spinning out of control with all the suspects that they brought in and were looking into. Now, as I said, this case was huge at this time, and because of all of the panic, rumors were definitely beginning to fly. The San Francisco Examiner even wrote an article suspecting Ruth was murdered by another woman. The headline read, "Woman Suspect in Spinster Slaying." In the article, the author explains that this crime was not your typical quote-unquote manly crime, which honestly I don't understand because, no offense, Men have been known to randomly rape and kill women, especially if the woman is a stranger to them. Unlike men, women usually don't kill based on just pure opportunity, and they're more often to kill people that they actually know. Plus, this animalistic and brutal style of killing just seems more likely for a man to act out. I wouldn't imagine a woman to use a concrete block to beat someone to death with, but that is just my opinion. Obviously, it's possible, but I would think it's probably unlikely. The article goes on to say that a woman must have done this because a brown hair strand was found under Ruth's fingernail, and that the strand was several shades lighter than Ruth's. Now, back then, as I'm sure you all know, there were not as many men with longer hair, so I can see why they would automatically assume that the hair had to be that of a woman's. This angle in the case was definitely very interesting, and the police did look into Ruth's life to see if she had any female enemies. But unfortunately, this lead went nowhere. So now the police are back at square one, and they're completely puzzled. That is, until they get a man coming forward and actually confesses to this murder. Donald J. Hazel, a former patient at the Patton State Hospital, came forward claiming that he is the slayer of Ruth Muir. Chief of Police George Sears said that the supposed confession does check out with the known facts regarding the murder. Now, Donald, being 30 years old, is a towering man of 225 pounds. I mean, he could definitely overpower a surprise victim. He confessed and said that he had loitered around La Jolla all afternoon that night and murdered Miss Muir that evening as she stood looking at the ocean. Hazel was taken into custody while the coroner's inquest into Muir's death was being held. So there you have it, the killer has finally been identified. Well, not entirely. Dr. G. Max Webster, superintendent of Patton Hospital, knew all about Donald and his case from the hospital, and he doubts that the confession is actually genuine. Quote, "Hazel is insane and would say anything. I would be inclined to question whether the confession means anything at all. I believe the officers are taking too much for granted." Deputy Sheriff Walter Blue and Police Officer Ed Stodler were the officers who Donald had originally told his confession to. The officers had found him wandering in a nearby street, muttering unintelligible questions. He even told the police he was 8 years old. Clearly, this man was not mentally sound. The officers reported that Donald also told them that he sometimes had psychic spells come over him and compel him to take a life. So, although it would have been nice to call this case solved, there wasn't much physical evidence actually tying Donald Hazel to the murder. Sadly, the murder of Ruth Muir stayed cold for almost 19 years. On May 20th, 1955, about 1 a.m., Mark Waters is awoken by a telephone call from San Juan Capistrano. Mr. Waters is a newspaper man for the Union Tribune, and on the phone, a strange man confessed to him that he was ready to tell all about the Ruth Muir murder case and wanted to know if Mr. Waters would come up to meet him. The stranger told him to bring along a fifth of whiskey and he would give him the whole story. This was obviously a huge break in the story. The strange man told the reporter, quote, "I killed her with a green club. I'm tired of living. You've got to do me a favor, fellow. You've got to give me the gas chamber." Mark Waters called the police and reported this confession. The police then arrest this caller and identified him as 45-year-old Wilbert Felix Friend. On trial, Wilbert recounts his version of the story. According to him, on the evening of August 31st, 1936, Wilbert, after drinking gin all night, walked along the beach in La Jolla. He had lost money playing pool and was in need of funds. So, he decided to rob any victim that he might come across that night. He removed a leg from a picnic table or bench with the purpose of using it as a club to attack his victim. He then walked until he saw Ruth Muir sitting alone on a bench. He knew this was the perfect chance to rob her and silently approached her from behind. He struck her on the head with the club, dragged her to a nearby ditch, and attempted to rape her. He was unable to effectively rob Miss Muir because the poor thing didn't have any valuable possessions on her, so he killed her instead. Her death was caused by fractures of the skull and many other injuries. Her death was a big deal in the community, and it brought back the fear of the Coast Fiend striking again. Only then did Wilbert learn that his victim had actually died. Feeling shocked and numb, Wilbert continued his work for a few more hours and then took off. He caught a streetcar to San Diego and thought he'd try to get away from himself, but ultimately, he couldn't. The night of the murder and the act of killing Ruth still seemed more or less like a dream, but he says he still had it in his mind what damage he had done. Now, after the body was found, the police underwent a manhunt and rounded up and contacted as many suspects as they could. On September 12, 1936, police officers left a note on a tent, which Wilbert was using as a dwelling at the time. The note asked for him to call the police station. Wilbert returned home to his tent and found the note. He then even called the police station as requested. Officers questioned him concerning the killing of Miss Muir, but he denied any knowledge of it. I mean, isn't that just wild? The police were talking directly to the murderer and had no idea. Time goes by, and Wilbert goes on to live his life and put this behind him. By May of 1955, Wilbert returns to California after living for some time in Detroit. That's when he calls up the reporter to confess to his crime. Now, police have already been down this road with Donald Hazel, and were a bit skeptical of this confession. But Wilbert answered all of their questions, and by all accounts seemed to be very sincere in his confession. But why confess after all this time? I mean, he's literally gotten away with murder for over a decade. But Wilbert explains that he had previously refrained from the confession because he didn't want to hurt people that were dear to him. He didn't want them to know how much of a monster he was. His father had died in 1945, his mother in 1953, and his wife in 1954. There was no one left who would be shamed or hurt by his confession. And honestly, he had nothing else to live for after all of their deaths. In regards to Wilbert's punishment, the court struggled with what should be done. It was either life in prison, or give Wilbert what he wants and give him the death penalty. In court, the defense counsel argued that there were mitigating circumstances. The biggest reason is the fact that the defendant turned himself in. Without him, there would have been no solution to this crime, and it would have gone down as just another unsolved case. The prosecutor retorted to this by saying, quote, "The only question in this case is the penalty." Counsel said that mitigating factor was the fact that he has confessed. He has had 19 years of freedom and of life, 19 years more than Miss Muir. And now, because his wife is dead, he has confessed. What is in mitigation in view of this offense because of that? Not one thing in this case shows mitigation. It is a brutal, unprovoked assault upon a defenseless woman. We feel from this evidence you should use your discretion. Use it wisely, study the case, and feel when you have come to the conclusion after you have thought it over that you will find this is a first-degree case and the imposition of the death penalty is justified. Now, the jury seemed to struggle, and honestly, they seemed very uneducated and leaned heavily on what the judge was kind of saying. He even had to explain to them what mitigation even meant. So because of the jury being somewhat led to a decision by the judge, a lot of people argue that this was grounds for a mistrial. And it was actually pretty hard to determine what actually happened to Wilbert. Now, the jury says this, quote, "We sincerely feel that from this evidence that the defendant is guilty of first-degree murder and that there is no mitigation and that the death penalty should be exercised by this jury in this case, and there is no mitigating factor." Now, I also read that the jury came back and said he was guilty, but were silent on the punishment. So, I'll be upfront with you guys. From my research, I honestly couldn't tell what actually happened to him. I don't know if he got life imprisonment or if he really did get the death penalty. Either way, justice was held, you know, he paid for his actions, but I don't know, what do you guys think? What do you guys prefer that he should have gotten? If you were in that jury, what would you have decided? I'd be curious to know. But there you have it. The case of Ruth Meir was finally solved. I just found this case to be so incredibly full of weird parallels and coincidences, very ironic circumstances as well. For starters, I found it to be super tragic and ironic that this independent woman who seemed to be very forward-thinking and, you know, fought for women's rights, she fought against abuse, that she would end up herself being abused by a man. It's just very sad that what she fought against ultimately took her out. I also found it very interesting that her case had not one, but two confessions. And lastly, it's honestly really creepy to me, and again, very ironic that for years the police were looking for a man whom they coined the Fiend. And in the end, they end up catching the murderer in Ruth's case, whose last name just so happens to be Friend. Friend, Fiend, very, very similar. Now, Wilbert may not have been the Fiend that they were looking for, but he definitely was the Friend, but not a friend to Ruth. Honestly, it's just super chilling of a coincidence that his last name would be so similar to the term that they called their quote-unquote serial killer. Speaking of the serial killer, I would love to go more in depth into all the murders of the Coast Fiend killer. There are some really weird ways the bodies were found, and it's honestly still unknown to this day if they were all murdered by one man, or if these multiple women were killed just separately and were completely unrelated. So let me know if that sounds intriguing to you guys as well. You can get in touch with me through any of the links in the show notes below. Big shout out to my lovely father for lending me his voice for the radio announcer. Today is actually his birthday, so happy birthday, Dad. I know you're listening. Anyways, guys, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you're looking for even more true crime content from fellow San Diego podcasters, we gotta represent here, right? Might I suggest you check out these ladies?
Hey, true crime listeners, check out our podcast, I Said Goddamn. We're a true crime comedy podcast hosted by two besties who like to share messed up cases that make you say goddamn. Every Sunday, we try to one-up each other's story by sharing a horrific case the other has never heard of. Along the way, we splash in some wildly inappropriate jokes and colorful language. Listen every Sunday from any of your favorite podcast directories. Also, follow us on Twitter at ISGDPodcast or visit our website, ISGDPodcast.com.
Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay safe.